From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Eastern Ukraine vote to secede dogged by fraud claims and violence. Growing numbers fleeing Nigeria attacks, getting help to the people of Syria, plus scientists creating plastic that repairs itself. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Eastern Ukrainians began voting early Sunday in a referendum on secession, with most voters saying they were voting for a break because of the military campaign by Kiev against pro-Russian separatists. Jamie Detmer is in Donetsk with our report.
Voting started briskly at polling stations in the Donetsk and Luhansk regions abutting Russia, but claims quickly mounted of multiple voting, and pro-unity activists posted a video showing how easy it was to vote more than once. The head of the Separatist Election Commission, Roman Lagin, told VOA multiple voting was impossible because people had to queue for about half an hour to vote. Therefore, no other precautions were necessary. The interim government in Kiev has denounced the referendum as illegal and a sham. Only one question is on the ballot: should the regions form independent republics? Most residents against secession say they will not cast a vote. But voters who did file into polling stations said the recent violence in the east was reason enough to secede. There is deep anger towards the interim government for its military campaign aimed at clearing out armed separatists from the dozens of government buildings they have seized in towns across the region. The deaths of at least 42 people last weekend in Odessa after clashes and a fire, and fighting Friday that left about 20 dead in Mariupol, is figuring prominently in the minds of the voters. 23-year-old translator Alex says,
I voted today because I believe that after the events that happened in Odessa and in Mariupol, a unity of Ukraine is impossible and that it is better to succeed.
The government in Kiev has been caught in a dilemma the past few weeks. By initially failing to take action against armed Moscow-backed separatists, it allowed the separatists to expand their reach. And when the central authorities later intervened, they inflamed local anger.
Потому що вони проти цього правительства, проти цієї банди. Що ж вони нас уничтожають?
Maria, an 81-year-old grandmother, breaks down in tears after voting in a polling station in Pushkin Boulevard in central Donetsk. She says the Kiev government consists of bandits and they're attacking people and burning them out. Much of the fear about Kiev can be linked to the output from Kremlin-controlled media outlets, which played up the anti-terrorist operations launched by Kiev. This strategy has linked the Kiev government's attempts to regain control in the public mind with the reprisal raids mounted during the Second World War by the Nazis. Analysts say Kiev has not helped to dispel that impression, pursuing hit-and-run tactics that deny little territory to armed and club-wielding separatists but leave local residents fearful. And violence marred the voting. In the southeastern city of Mariupol, there were reports separatists hanged a local police chief. In Krasnoyarsk, pro-unity fighters managed to stop voting at a polling station. Analysts say the referendum does not meet international standards and is open to fraud. No election monitors have been sent from foreign countries. Analysts worry about the integrity of a vote being held while separatist intimidation and abductions are going on. Comments by election chief Lagin will not help disarm criticism of the integrity of the vote. He told VOA separatists have been working off a 2012 electoral database, but it is incomplete and they've been adding names. He says also that anyone who turns up at a polling station and is not on the list is allowed to vote. Many voters in Donetsk and Luhansk say they hope if the referendum approves the region's status as independent republics, Russia will quickly agree to annex them. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Donetsk.
And as some eastern Ukrainians vote on possible independence from Kiev, much of Washington remains focused on Ukraine's May 25th national elections. VOA's Michael Bowman reports that bipartisan support has grown in the U.S. Congress for tougher sanctions against Moscow in hopes of safeguarding Ukraine's democratic exercise.
Referendums went forward Sunday in eastern Ukraine despite widespread statements condemning the votes as illegal and illegitimate. Adding to the tension, no sign Russian President Vladimir Putin is making good on last week's promise to withdraw troops from the Ukrainian border, according to U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel.
Well, they're not leaving, as far as we can tell. You'd have to ask President Putin as to why he says they're leaving and when, in fact, they're not.
Sanctions imposed by the United States and its NATO allies do not appear to have altered Moscow's aggressive posture towards Ukraine.
Russia continues to isolate itself for a short-term gain. The Russians may feel that somehow they're winning, but the world is not about just short-term.
Well, this is the same playbook that we saw in Crimea playing out in eastern Ukraine. It is an insurgency-type action by the Russians to create unrest.
Republican Senator Kelly Ayotte wants the United States to target entire sectors of the Russian economy before Ukraine's national elections May 25th.
It's time for the administration to issue the sectoral sanctions before the elections so that those elections will not be disrupted so that they can go forward. I believe issuing the sanctions when the elections are interfered with is too late.
Fellow Republican Lindsey Graham wants President Barack Obama to seek formal congressional approval of further punitive measures against Russia.
Instead of doing this by executive order, Mr. President, come to the Congress and see if you could get bipartisan buy-in to sectoral sanctions, which would send a stronger message to Putin. It would hurt the Russian economy more, and I think it would bolster our allies.
I think we should be pushing the Europeans hard for sectoral-based sanctions.
Democratic Senator Chris Murphy agrees Russia must pay a heavier price, but says the United States cannot do it alone.
The fact is that the United States acting unilaterally on sanctions may harm our security interests, not advance them. U.S. sanctions alone are not enough to change the calculus on the ground in Moscow, and ultimately may give political impetus to Putin within Russia to continue his provocations.
Late Saturday, the Obama administration restated its threat to, quote, impose greater costs on Russia, but did not say when it might do so. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
You can stay up to date on what's happening in Ukraine, plus the world's reaction, by going to our website, voanews.com. Still ahead, the latest on the kidnapped Nigerian girls.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military.
You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
civilians. Sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians. This
with all that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
Some of the Nigerian schoolgirls who managed to escape from their Boko Haram kidnappers are speaking out about the frightening incident that continues for hundreds of their schoolmates. This abducted girl who escaped said, "We reached a forest. We said to ourselves, since other girls were jumping off the truck, we better jump even if they're going to kill us, because we didn't know where they were taking us. We jumped out and started to run." And this girl added, "They picked some girls among us who fetched water and cooked for us. I bent down as I was going to eat, but my instinct told me to run, and I and another girl bolted." The girls joined families of their classmates in Borno State as the parents made some emotional appeals to authorities to do more in rescuing the girls missing now nearly a month. This mother of an abducted girl said the very Monday the kidnappings happened, we thought soldiers were going to be sent to get our daughters. Had soldiers been deployed, quite sure, no doubt our daughters would have been returned. But they did not happen, and it's now been 3 weeks. Amnesty International is saying the Nigerian security forces failed to act on warnings that began coming in more than 4 hours before Boko Haram attacked the school in Chibok late on April the 14th. Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan has said the kidnappers have no hiding place, but their whereabouts still remain a mystery. Increasing kidnappings and attacks on civilians in northeastern Nigeria has displaced well over 200,000 people inside the country and caused tens of thousands of others to flee across the borders. The UNHCR calls the brutality and frequency of the attacks unprecedented. We get more now from VOA's Joe DiCapua.
Reports of abductions, killings, and attacks on schools and villages have now become commonplace in northeastern Nigeria. The recent kidnapping of hundreds of schoolgirls by the militant group Boko Haram has received worldwide attention, but the incident is one of many. Next week marks the first anniversary of the declaration of a state of emergency in three Nigerian states, Adamawa, Borno, and Yobe. Elaine Koh is a spokesperson for UNHCR, who recently visited northeastern Nigeria and South Niger.
A lot of the people we have interviewed, whether in Nigeria or in neighboring countries who are refugees, are telling us that they cannot bear any more violence, and so they decide to flee.
Koh says the Nigeria Emergency Management Agency is keeping track of the number of displaced.
There are 250,000 people who would be now internally displaced within Nigeria, mainly in the three northeastern states. Some of the people who are victims of violence fled to neighboring countries, to Cameroon, Chad, and Niger. We estimated about 61,000 persons who have fled to the neighboring countries.
She says people are fleeing for their lives.
Some of them have been witnessing attacks on their family members, the killings of their family members or friends. So as you can imagine, it's something which is really traumatic. When people are telling you that their villages have been completely razed, it's something really overwhelming. They talk to you also about grenades which are being launched into crowded markets. You have dozens of people who are being killed and with their livestock.
Many also have had their crops burned. Koh recently spoke to one young man who survived an attack on his school in Yobe State.
He told me that a group of insurgents came to his school at night. They gathered all the young men, all the students, in one room. They told them that going to school was forbidden, and they started to shoot at the boys. The young man I talked to and who survived got two bullets in the stomach, two in the arms and one in the leg. He told me at that time that 40 students were killed during the attack, including 10 of his friends.
While he was recovering from his wounds, he says the same insurgents attacked the hospital, and he thought they had come to kill him. Instead, they raided the hospital's medical supplies. The UNHCR spokesperson says conditions at the borders of Niger, Chad, and Cameroon can be chaotic, especially in South Niger.
The border area remains very volatile. There are military operations going on also to try to contain the violence. Most of the refugees who are in South Niger are in the Difa region, which is a very remote and arid area. We estimate that about 700 to 1,000 persons are arriving each week to this region of South Niger from Nigeria.
Some are also reaching remote areas on Lake Chad. Koh says another area of concern is Cameroon's far north region, which is across the border from Nigeria's Borno state. On May 5th, an attack on a market there killed 100 people. In the past year, nearly 7,000 people have fled Borno state to Cameroon. Not all the refugees are Nigerian. Some are migrant workers who are returning to their home countries to escape the violence. And some who cross the border are being arrested as authorities check to see whether any might belong to militant groups. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Also in Washington, President Obama's wife, Michelle Obama, said she and her husband are outraged at the kidnappings of the schoolgirls in Nigeria. VOA's Kent Klein has more.
Mrs. Obama expressed empathy for the parents of the 276 abducted girls.
In these girls, Barack and I see our own daughters. We see their hopes and their dreams. And we can only imagine the anguish their parents are feeling right now.
The First Lady also spoke out against the Boko Haram terrorist group which kidnapped the girls. Its leader has said the group intends to sell the girls into slavery.
This unconscionable act was committed by a terrorist group determined to keep these girls from getting an education. Grown men attempting to snuff out the aspirations of young girls.
The United States and other countries have sent teams of technical experts to help the Nigerian government in its search effort.
And I want you to know that Barack has directed our government to do everything possible to support the Nigerian government's efforts to find these girls and bring them home.
Nigeria's government has been sharply criticized for its inability to rescue the girls almost a month after they were taken. But a Nigerian Army spokesman, General Chris Olukolade, says it's been a difficult job.
Some of the information given have turned out, in many occasions, to be misleading and to be exhausting of the search teams. Nevertheless, this will not discourage the collaborative efforts that are ongoing.
Rescuing the girls unharmed is the main challenge, according to the Director General of the Nigeria Orientation Agency, Mike Omeha.
The essence of rescue is not to kill everybody, but to bring people alive. And so it takes time if you want to rescue somebody, even if you know where he is, so that you go in and get him out safe and in one piece.
Boko Haram, which wants to impose Islamic Sharia law on Nigeria, has killed more than 1,500 people this year. Kent Klein, VOA News, Washington.
Meantime, French President François Hollande is calling on African leaders to meet in Paris later this week for a summit on how to deal with Boko Haram. South African President Jacob Zuma says the ruling African National Congress regards its election win as a strong sign of approval of the work that the party has done over the past 20 years. Mr. Zuma addressed supporters shortly after election officials announced the ANC won the vast majority of National Assembly seats in last week's polling, setting the stage for Mr. Zuma to serve a second five-year term as president.
Those who are not with the people are not going to vote for them. And that's what has happened. And that's why other parties, of those who spoke so violently in parliament, they've been reduced into little dwarfs in parliament.
Mr. Zuma said the victory confirmed that the ANC remained the only true hope for most South Africans, particularly the poor and those in the working class. The ANC has won every election since South Africa's first democratic polling in 1994 after the end of apartheid. Also in the news, police in Yemen say a suicide bomber detonated a vehicle filled with explosives. At least 12 officers outside a police building in the country's south were killed. Meanwhile, in the capital Sana'a, the Interior Ministry says three gunmen were killed after attempting an attack on a presidential guard checkpoint. The two attacks appear to be in reprisal for an army operation to drive al-Qaeda out of the southern provinces of Abyan and Shabwa. A senior United Nations official is accusing the Syrian government of using humanitarian aid as a tactical weapon of war. The UN reports 9.6 million people inside the country are affected by the war, and the number is growing. It says 6.5 million are internally displaced. More than 2.7 million have fled to refuge in neighboring countries. The director of operations for the Organization for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, John Ging, says 5,000 people are being killed every month and that more than 150,000 people already have died since the war began.
We're becoming numb to the scale and the extent of the brutality of this conflict on ordinary people. So, yes, we are at the limit of what we can do. We're at the limit. Our colleagues are putting their lives on the line. Our colleagues are losing their lives. in this conflict. And yet we cannot reach millions.
King says people in Syria have run out of coping mechanisms. Public facilities such as education, health, and other services are collapsing. He says people are reduced to the very basics of survival. He says the number of people wounded in the war so far is escalating, but they are not receiving the treatment they desperately need. He calls this an abomination and puts the blame on the government of President Bashar al-Assad.
Denying humanitarian access is a tactic in this conflict, and starvation, increasing the misery of those in places that are besieged, places that are denied access to humanitarian assistance, is a tactic that is being utilized, and it's not acceptable. In terms of who are taking the medical supplies out of the convoys, it's the government of Syria.
King is appealing to the international community for support. He says people need outside help to get food, water, medical care, and other essential supplies. He said aid agencies are doing their best, but there is only so much they can do without money, and he says that's dwindling by the day. The UN has launched a record $6.5 billion humanitarian appeal to aid Syrians.
VOA Special English, a way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
Modeled on the blood vessels that make up the human circulatory system, scientists have created a plastic material that repairs itself. Researchers believe self-regenerating plastic could be used in many ways. We got the story from VOA's Jessica Berman.
Imagine a sheet of plastic with a tear or hole in the middle. Suddenly, the breach begins to fill in. Within seconds, the hole is completely covered with new plastic material. In a couple of hours, the plastic is as hard as ever. Central to this regeneration process, according to inventor Scott White of the University of Illinois Urbana, are parallel vascular-like channels through which liquid repair material is funneled onto the damaged plastic. A big challenge in the development of the self-regeneration system was gravity, which would make the repair material leak out. But scientists developed two chemicals which mix and congeal immediately after reaching the damaged site. The material then fills the hole or crack in the plastic by folding on top of itself until the entire breach is patched. White says scientists got the idea from the human circulatory system and the body's use of platelets to repair a wound.
If we have a major gash, you know, there's a possibility that we could bleed out, but if that gash is not too severe, then we should see a blood clot form, and then the repair process takes place underneath that clot. And this is the same kind of principle here.
Self-healing plastic could be used in a number of ways, White says. For example, it could be used as a protective coating on metal.
If you had a regenerative coating, in this case, you could basically walk away and be assured that there was always going to be a coating on that substrate and never have to worry about a corrosion process happening anymore.
White, a professor of aerospace engineering, says that might be useful on the decks of ships, which commonly get scraped and dinged, causing rust to form, or as a coating on car bumpers to repair dings and scrapes. White says the research is in the early stages. Currently, the repair is visible, but in time, he says, it'll be difficult to see where the damage was after the plastic regenerates itself. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
It is time now to say goodbye and to thank you for tuning in to the Voice of America today for International Edition. You can find us always on the radio and always on the internet at voanews.com. And we hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Carl Starling, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Monday.
This is Today in History. On May 12, 1780, American defenders surrendered to British forces at Charleston, South Carolina. It represented one of the worst American defeats during the Revolutionary War. In 1789, the Society of St. Tammany was formed in New York by Revolutionary War soldiers. A group of city political bosses meeting at Tammany Hall later made Tammany a byword for big city corruption. In 1820, Florence Nightingale was born. She is widely viewed as the founder of modern nursing. Her tireless efforts in organization and sanitation drastically cut the mortality rate among British wounded during the Crimean War. In 1932, the body of the kidnapped son of Charles Lindbergh was found in Hopewell, New Jersey. Lindbergh was an aviation hero who was the first man to fly solo across the Atlantic Ocean. The kidnapping and murder was one of the most notorious crimes of the 20th century. In 1949, the Soviet Union lifted its 11-month land blockade against West Berlin. Following a dispute between the Soviet Union and its post-war Western allies over the future of Berlin, the Soviet leadership implemented an economic blockade that it thought would force submission to its demands. However, a massive U.S.-British airlift of vital supplies to West Berlin circumvented the blockade and finally forced Soviet capitulation. In 1963, Bob Dylan walked off the set of America's premier TV variety program, The Ed Sullivan Show. Dylan was not happy when the show's censors banned a song he wanted to sing. That song poked fun at the ultra-conservative U.S. group known as the John Birch Society. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Official corruption knows no borders, afflicting nations large and small. It lines the pockets of unscrupulous government leaders and their cronies with ill-gotten gains, while depriving citizens of vital resources. When officials break their oath of office to convert public wealth for private gain, it undermines the fundamental promise of democracy and the rule of law. Asked by the new government in Ukraine to help recover suspected millions of dollars looted by former President Viktor Yanukovych, the United States has launched an initiative to aid that and other fledgling democracies to locate and secure public assets. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder, speaking at a conference in London on April 29th, announced formation of a team of special agents within the Federal Bureau of Investigation to help nations that request our aid to speed up probes into the financial dealings of former leaders who have been removed from office and are suspected of absconding with monies and other assets they diverted to their control while in power. Speed is important because funds can move quickly through the international banking system and the money trail grow cold. Banking records and other evidence of where the assets originated, such as diverted foreign aid, and where they went, can easily be destroyed. In the case of Ukraine, the U.S. sent a team of FBI agents and prosecutors there within days of Yanukovych's departure. About 10 team members are still there, sorting through records, tracing bank accounts, and advising Ukrainian law enforcement officials on how to do the same. Ukraine is not alone. Following a popular uprising in January 2011, Zayn el-Abidin Ben Ali was forced to step down and flee Tunisia amid a trail of corruption charges. The Tunisian government and Interpol are still investigating, but estimates of his plundering reach billions of euros. His assets, held in foreign banks, have been frozen, and an international warrant issued for his arrest. The suspected looting is even wider in Cote d'Ivoire, where deposed President Laurent Gbagbo, 90 members of his government, and 13 companies associated with him face corruption charges. Worldwide, the looting and diversion of public assets by corrupt officials is part of cross-border financial movements totaling an estimated $1.6 trillion a year. Our nation's interest in helping other nations in this way is twofold. Nations ruled by corrupt leaders can be breeding grounds for other types of crime, including terrorism, and they threaten U.S. and other international interests. But just as important, it will help ensure the welfare and well-being of the citizens of the nations to which the monies they rightfully belong.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.